Woodford Folk Festival is held every year on the Sunshine Coast hinterland in Queensland. And one of the regular visitors to Woodford is Bob Hawke. So when the festival asked me to host an event, well, Bob was the first person I thought of. I remember seeing Bob on TV as ACTU leader when I was a kid, and then he was on our screens every other night as Prime Minister from 1983 to 1991. And in that time, we got to know every line on his face, his mannerisms, his Australian voice, and he wore his emotions publicly, and we were all made privy to his family life. To be honest, I wasn't really interested in revisiting all that. There's not much about Bob Hawke's private life we don't already know. I was more interested in asking him about the lonely business of being a Prime Minister. Very few living Australians know what it's like to sit in that room and make those decisions. And Bob Hawke governed in a time when it seemed easier for governments to set a national agenda compared to now. I spoke to Bob on Woodford's concert hall stage on an incredibly humid night in front of several thousand people, and there were industrial fans on stage, which affected the sound quality a little, but the cadences of Bob Hawke's unique voice ring out loud and clear. In fact, as I was talking with him, I couldn't help but think to myself, oh God, he sounds so much like Bob Hawke. We were introduced to the stage by the founder of the Woodford Folk Festival, Bill Horrocks. For many years now, you've been coming to Woodford. What keeps bringing you back? Is it the music, the juggling workshops? What is it?
It's a mixture of all the things. You get the serious stuff, you get the comedy, you get the dancing, music, and most of all, it's the people. We all owe an enormous debt of gratitude to the bloke who introduced us, Bill Horrocks. I don't think there's any Australian who over the years has given more pleasure to more millions of Australians than Bill Horrocks.
Yeah. Should Tony Abbott give him a knighthood, perhaps, Bob? What do you reckon?
If Bill accepted it, it would end a beautiful friendship.
You were born in Bordertown in South Australia. Your earliest childhood years were spent in country South Australia, Bob.
Yep.
If you search back in your memory and think of the earliest pictures you have in your mind, what kind of pictures do you see?
Inevitably, it's my father and my mother. The most brilliant decision I ever made, and I've made a few. But easily the most brilliant was my choice of parents. I grew up in a house full of love. Both my mother and father always encouraged me to speak my mind. You know, when I see so many people missing out, I feel so sad for them, because there's nothing more important than a nurturing, loving household to grow up in.
Do you think that love you had from your mum and your dad was like an anchor for you in life?
In my early years, it was certainly an anchor. I mean, as I grew up, I developed my own substance and anchorage, if you like. But in those early years, it certainly was.
Did they encourage you to think of yourself as a future Prime Minister?
Well, not in the first few years, but as time went on, I think the idea got in Mum's head.
She put that to you? She said, you'll be Prime Minister, or you might be Prime Minister?
No, as I got on and moved into the industrial labour movement and got more involved in political leadership of the party, they thought that perhaps something might happen.
Something might happen. Did you ever resent the high expectations they had for you at times?
No, never, because I knew it came from a great love.
Your father was a minister, a Congregationalist minister. Mm-hmm. What was the moment you felt you couldn't go down that path with him and be a Christian like your father?
It happened at the end of 1952. I'd been awarded the Rhodes Scholarship to go to Oxford, and I went to India to the World Christian Youth Congress as a part of the Australian delegation. And on Christmas Eve, there was this great party for all the delegates at the mansion of one of the very rich Christians there. They were singing The World of Christ We Bring. And I looked out at the gates, and there were these starving people looking in as we feasted on these laden tables. I thought there was something wrong about this, and I left the party. I went back to my rooms and got some clothing and wandered around the streets where these kids were lying huddled in poverty and gave them some clothing, and that was a turning point for me.
Did you give it away because you didn't believe in God or because you just thought it was irrelevant?
Well, I thought that Christianity was irrelevant to the needs of people, that it was concerned too much with itself and not with what the essential teachings of Christ were about. So, I have always been driven by the basic, what I see as the basic principles of Christianity, by something my father said to me when I was young. He said, if you believe in the fatherhood of God, you must necessarily, logically, believe in the brotherhood of man. Great truth.
You had a serious motorcycle accident on your Black Panther motorbike.
Yeah.
At age 17. What happened, Bob?
It was my first year at university in 1947, and during the second term holidays, I'd ridden the motorbike, which I'd just acquired, down to the university to look up some stuff in the law library. I wasn't feeling well. I went to the factory and had a drink and an aspirin, and then got on my bike and riding home through King's Park in Perth, and I just sort of blacked out. I got thrown off the bike, and I was carrying a big iron stand for the bike, which I just acquired, and I got pitched off and landed on my stomach and ruptured the spleen. And I was in agony, absolute agony, because the spleen was ruptured, bleeding. I was taken to hospital, and I was on the critically ill list for about a week. That was really life and death like that. And when I recovered, I sort of had the feeling that my life had been spared and that I should make the most of it and work hard. Up until then, I'd sort of coasted. So I then decided I would really work, and made a big difference in my life.
You joined the ACTU as a researcher and eventually became president of the ACTU in 1969. Yeah. I read some articles. I remember when I was doing politics, I read some articles from the time where they worried about this terrible demon socialist that had taken over the ACTU with the support of the left. You were never that guy, though, were you? You chose to pursue reform through existing institutions, yeah, rather than as a more radical figure as a proto-Marxist.
I'm basically a social democrat. I don't think there's a role for government to run airlines, for instance. There are things that the people of Australia need which the private sector will never do. And government should concentrate on doing those things which only it can do.
You began speaking out in favour of consensus and reconciliation. That's been a major theme your whole life as an industrial leader and as a politician. Is there something of your father in that? When I hear you talk about that, you actually do sound like a Congregationalist minister, Bob.
Well, yes, sir. He always tried to find something good in people.
Have you always been able to do that, Bob?
Some have escaped my capacity to find my goodness. But
I say that because I know Neville Rann used to quietly sort of believe in hate, actually. He used to say, you actually have to hate the opposition.
Yeah, well, this is something that I absolutely reject. I'm simply not a good hater. The world does much better if we look to one another, find the things on which we can agree, and where we disagree, to talk sensibly about our points of disagreement. You know, I've got a lot of good friends on the other side of politics. I mean, I even get on well with Tony Abbott. Personally, not these politics.
Gough Whitlam died recently. In the 1975 crisis, you were president of the ACTU and also president of the Labor Party.
Yeah.
The dismissal of Gough Whitlam is one of those kind of great ruptures in Australian politics. That moment, what do you remember of that day and how you were told that Whitlam had been dismissed by the Governor-General?
I can remember exactly. I was having lunch in a hotel in Melbourne and got the message, so I immediately knew I had to get up there, and there was some pressure from within the trade union movement that I should call a national stoppage, and I rejected that idea because I said our complaint is that the due processes for decision making haven't been taken. It doesn't make sense. It's not logical to say that in that situation we will act in this way. And that was a point of view which Gough accepted and embraced, and my colleagues came to understand.
The act of Sir John Kerr in sacking the government of the day, Paul Keating has said if he'd been Prime Minister, he would have torn it up. Would you have torn it up, the letter of dismissal?
I haven't thought about what I would do.
Really? Really? You never thought about what you'd do as Prime Minister if the Governor-General...
I thought about what I'd do as Prime Minister into the future. I didn't see much point in dwelling on the past.
So you don't know what you would do? Would you have accepted that?
Well, it's completely hypothetical. I certainly would have done what Gough didn't do, and that is immediately go to the Senate. He went back to the Lodge and didn't go to the Senate, and if he'd gone to the Senate, it perhaps could have been different.
In 79, you gave the Boyer lectures. The theme, again, was the resolution of conflict. Mm. You talked about reconciliation, consensus. Why did you think that was a message that would suit those times?
Well, you remember what 79 was like. The country was very divided. The Conservative governments were setting unions against employers and one section of the community against another. I knew this wasn't good for our country, and I thought it was worth talking about.
I'm going to quote you from your Boyer lecture, what you said about women. You said, in sum, the truth is that we luxuriate in the comfortable assertion that women enjoy equality. We have salved our consciences by eliminating the more obvious discriminations like unequal rates of pay for work of equal value. But in fact, we have not eliminated the inheritance of the millennia that women are lesser beings, an inheritance which still manifests itself in a whole range of prejudice and other forms of discrimination. You said that in 1979. Has much changed?
Well, certainly I changed a lot of that as Prime Minister. We had legislation providing for equality of opportunity. So we did quite a bit, and I still remember the gratitude that was expressed to me on behalf of women by the fact that we just didn't talk, we did things.
You gave up alcohol to become Prime Minister. A few people said at the time you could be quite nasty on the grog, aggressive, bullying even. Was that true? Is that fair?
Yeah, I was not the most lovable human being if I'd had too much to drink. I got great pluses out of my drinking. I mean, it was part of the oiling, if you like, of the relationships with a hell of a lot of people, which played an important part in my rise through the ranks. But once I made up my mind that I was going to go into Parliament and go for the Prime Ministership, I knew that I must give up drinking because I could not afford to disgrace my country or the Prime Minister, the office of Prime Minister, by bad drunken behaviour. So I made the decision in May of 1980. I made it just before going on my last annual visit to the International Labour Organisation, which used to have a 3-week conference in June in Geneva. And I knew that if I could get through that month, I'd be right. So I got off the plane and they were waiting to meet me, and they said, "Oh, we're going to have a drink." I said, "No, I've given it up." And their jaws dropped, and they spent the next week or so trying to dissuade me, but then they saw I was a dingham. So I didn't have another drop for 13 years.
The ILO never recovered from that, Bob, did it?
I was still reeling a bit.
You had to tear down Bill Hayden to become Labor leader. I don't think anyone thinks you got any enjoyment out of that. In fact, there was a lot of grief involved in that. Nonetheless, do you think it's better for leaders to ascend to the leadership, or is it better in the end for them to have to commit that act of fratricidal violence?
It depends on the circumstances. Sometimes an orderly agreed transition is appropriate and accepted. But Bill, naturally enough, he'd done a lot of work, and I have always acknowledged the good work he did as leader in getting the party ready in terms of policies for...
But how about you? Do you think that act of actually having to defeat someone can make you a stronger Prime Minister, a better Prime Minister in the exercise of power like that?
No. You're going to be as good a Prime Minister as you've got the innate capacity to be. The fact that you have to knock someone over doesn't add to that inner strength.
The day that Bob Hawke replaced Bill Hayden as Labor leader in 1983 was one of the most dramatic days in our political history. Hayden agreed to step down in a hugely emotional meeting in Brisbane, but in Canberra, at almost exactly the same time, the Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser went to see the Governor-General to advise a general election. Fraser was hoping to call the election before Labor switched leaders, but he was too late. The new Labor leader, Bob Hawke, immediately entered the election campaign with the slogan, "Bringing Australia Together." And on election night, Labor won easily. Bob and his wife Hazel entered the national tally room. Cheers.
You're listening at home because I can hardly hear myself speak. Mr. Hawke is now standing up on a scaffold, looking down at the crowd, which is down below here at the tally room in Canberra.
Mr. Hawke changed from Prime Minister-elect to Prime Minister.
Very pleased and happy, understandably, with the degree of enthusiasm.
Mr. Hawke's concentrating on refining the shape of his government, working with the men who'll be at the heart of that first cabinet. Paul Keating, the Treasurer, Senator John Button, frontbenchers Mick Young and Don Grimes, and Deputy Leader Lionel Bowen. The emphasis is on careful, measured decision-making.
When you became Prime Minister on election night, people around you said you were eerily calm as the news came through that the ALP had won a landslide victory. You were calm.
Well, I was calm. It was fairly clear we were going to win and win well. And so my mind was turning over what are the things we have to do, what are the immediate issues and so on. It wasn't a time in my judgment for going crazy.
You had to tone down your larrikinism as well as give up the drink to become Prime Minister.
Not entirely.
No, not entirely. But a hell of a lot. Geez, the strain of that must have hurt at times. You have a lot of power as Prime Minister, but you lose the ability to completely speak your mind at all times, don't you?
Well, there are times in which it's not appropriate in terms of the interests of the government to say exactly what you're thinking about someone or some issue. You learn to cope with that.
I'm going to quote Paul Kelly's book, you know, The End of Certainty, where he begins the chapter on the Labor Party with this. He says, "Bob Hawke and Paul Keating aspired to create a new Labor Party, first by instinct, then by conviction. The hallmark of their Labor Party was its governing mentality. Their approach was dominated not by Labor history, but by contemporary intellectual trends. Their motive was not hostility towards the mixed capitalist economy, but a determination to improve its performance." Is that the view of hindsight, or were they very much your real intentions at the time? Did it come out of improvisation or intent?
That's mixed, that quotation, in terms of its reality and unreality. To say that we weren't influenced by the past is just absurd. The fundamental values of the Labor Party, equality of opportunity, a decent society, these things were the underlying basic values going back over the years of the Labor Party, and they remain compelling forces for me.
You did some similar things to the Thatcher government insofar as you brought the animal energies of the market back into Australia, gave it a lot more influence. The dollar was floated, the tariff war was brought down, a whole lot of deregulation of the economy came in. Did you see yourself as being Thatcherite, or in what ways were you distinctly different to Thatcher?
She was, let's take this for starters. She was fundamentally anti-union. I was fundamentally pro-union.
Nonetheless, during that whole period, union membership waned to to the point where it's much more part of the workforce.
Yeah, but that was something that was happening all around the world. It was happening because of the changes in the method of production and the composition of the workforce. The influence of the unions we made very important, and you talk about how we changed the economy. We would not have been able to do that if it hadn't been for the avid cooperation of the trade union leadership and most of its membership. And when I hear conservative politicians knocking trade unions, I almost want to vomit, because the fact is, without the cooperation of the trade union movement at that time, we would not have been able to make those fundamental changes to the Australian economy which strengthened it.
You had strong friendships with the US Secretary of State under Reagan, George Shultz, Vice President George Bush Sr. You met President Reagan several times as well. Now, you had real friendships with those other two guys I mentioned, but Reagan was a really odd duck. The more I read about Reagan, the more strange he seems, and he's defied the ability of biographers to even find the kind of human being underneath that kind of surface. Did he strike you as odd when you met him in the Oval Office, Bob?
Not odd. He did some odd things. Our first meeting, which was in June of 1983, he was the first international leader to send a message of congratulation to me and ask me to visit him as soon as we could. So we went into the White House, the meeting room, and long table, and I sat on one side of the middle and Ronald sat opposite me, and he started off saying some very nice things about me and then said, "Well, Bob," he says, "you're our honoured guest, perhaps you'd like to start the conversation." So I thanked him, and I remember my first question was an economic one. The United States was just coming out of a relatively mild recession, and my question essentially was, what was their estimate of the rate of growth of the US economy in the next couple of years? Next thing I know, the President of the United States got some cards in his hands. He got, comes to economy, I guess it was, and takes a card, reads a couple of sentences, and then turns to Donald Reagan, the Secretary of the Treasury. He said, "Well, Donald," he said, "this is in your court." He said, "perhaps you'd like to take this up with Bob." So for the next 5 minutes, the Prime Minister of Australia and the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States have an intelligent discussion about these economic issues. The most powerful man in the world sits there and says, "bugger all." When that finished, he said, "Well, Bob, that was mighty interesting. What would you like to turn to next?" So the next question was a foreign affairs issue. Here come the cards again. Reads a couple of sentences, and he turns to George Shultz. He says, "George," he said, "this is, I think, in your court. Perhaps you'd like to take this up with Bob." So the Prime Minister of Australia and the Secretary of State of the United States have an intelligent discussion for about 5 minutes. Most powerful man in the world sits there and doesn't say anything. And in the end he says, "Well, that was mighty interesting, Bob." And so it went on. And of course the thing that Ron loved most was a lunch and swapping jokes. And as we were going out, my blokes said to me, "Well, amazed about this, and we're carrying on about it." So, "wait a minute, what would you think's more sensible if a fella doesn't really know much about the issues and he passes over to those who do? Isn't that more sensible to get more out of it?" And I sort of agreed. I made a number of official visits to the United States, and this is the commentary about Reagan. "On not one of those visits did I meet anyone on either side of politics who didn't like the guy personally. He was a lovable bloke personally. Reagan was. He knew his weaknesses. He knew that he wasn't well informed. He surrounded himself by very intelligent, strong advisors, and he relied on their judgment."
Well, it's no wonder people liked him if he wouldn't have a political argument with anyone.
You know, when he got on the stump, he would, but in the running of government, he basically left the decision-making. I mean, he obviously had to put the final imprimatur on things, but he relied very heavily on good advisers.
One of the best relationships you had with a world leader was with Zhao Zhang, who was the Chinese premier, who's a tragic figure in a lot of ways.
He was. At the time of Tiananmen Square, he went out to the students and offered, he said, if you disband, he said, I will see that certain things are done. But the woman who was leading the students just wouldn't listen to him, and so what followed, followed. A tragedy. If they'd listened to him, things could have been very different.
Your decision to allow the Chinese students who were in Australia at the time to stay, it was made quite emotionally. I was in Beijing recently and met former Ambassador Jeff Raby, who talked about showing you a whole lot of work done by Chinese-Australian artists like Ah Shan and Zhou Aishen, who were two of the people who you allowed to stay, who've become major Australian Chinese artists.
Yeah, it was a big and important decision for the students, but it was also a big and important decision for Australia. We benefited enormously from it. I just want to quickly make the point how intelligently the Chinese leadership came to understand this issue. After the events of Tiananmen Square, the very close relationship I had with the Chinese leaders went into deep freeze. I'd had a closer relationship with them than any other world leader, basically. I acted as a conduit for them with Washington, and the relationship was extraordinarily close. But it went into deep freeze until I finished as Prime Minister. Then, a year after I finished as Prime Minister, I got a call from the Chinese consul, could he come and see me? And I said, of course. So he came to see me, and he said, he was a bit embarrassed for, and then he said, I've been asked by my government if you'd be prepared to make a visit to China. And I said, of course I would, because my view was we had to look forward and try and build things. So I went up there and staying in the Daoyutai, which is the government guest house. You don't have an appointment made in advance. You sit there and then they tell you when they're ready to see you. So the message came through that President Jiang Zemin was ready to see me, so I went down to the headquarters, and Jiang Zemin was sitting behind a table with his inner cabinet there, and he got up when I came into the room. He walked across and held out his hand. He said, Mr. Hawke, there's one thing I want to say to you. I thought, shit, what's this? And he said, Mr. Hawke, don't you know that China never forgets its friends? And we want you to know that we regard you as one of our best friends. So the important thing was they'd come to understand that my action had flowed from a deep affection and love for the Chinese people and the country of China. And that's gone on well ever since.
I know one of the things you're proudest of in office is the work your government did, continuing the Fraser government's strong opposition to apartheid in South Africa. Under you, Australia was right at the forefront of putting international pressure on the South African government apartheid.
It was even more than that. I think as soon as I became Prime Minister, I became the leader of the group in the Commonwealth Heads of Government working against apartheid. At that stage, there were trade sanctions, but they weren't working. So at the 1987 Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Canada, I said, look, sanctions aren't working. I said, I thought about this, and I think the only thing that can possibly break this regime is a system of investment sanctions. Well, I said, how do we do it? I said, well, there's a bloke in New York, an Australian, Wolfenson, who runs a small bank there, and why don't I fly him up here and we talk about it with him? So Wolfenson flew up. I put the idea to him and I said, do you think it will? He said, I think it can. Will you help us? Of course it will. So I got the senior people from Treasury, from our Treasury, working with him, and we organised this widespread system of investment sanctions. And the last finance minister of the apartheid government, Baron de Plessis, went on record as saying it was the investment sanctions which finally broke apartheid.
Did Nelson Mandela recognise that?
Well, let me say this, that when Nelson was freed, The first country he visited after a couple of African countries was Australia, and he came out here and he walked into my office, took my hand, and he said, "Bob," he said, "I want you to know I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for you." When he said, "you," I wouldn't have been able to do what I did without the support of my government.
We've had this unbroken stretch of economic growth in Australia pretty much since the 1990 recession, and people are inclined to attribute that to the reform work done by you and Paul Keating on the economy over those periods of government. Nonetheless, that was a long time in coming, and there was a terrible recession in 1990. I just wonder if you ever reached a point of despair with that.
Well, I was very upset. We in government made the mistake that was made by the rest of the world and economists around the world. We underestimated the resilience of the market economy after the stock market crash of 87. We left interest rates too low for too long, and so when we had to put them up, we had to put them up pretty high, and it did bring about a recession, as you say. And so I was very disappointed. And, of course, hindsight is a marvellous instrument, but nevertheless, because of the basic reforms we had made, the economy did recover strongly.
The recession was a key factor in you losing the Labor leadership and the Prime Ministership with it. Julia Gillard, I interviewed her recently, and she wrote in her book about how wrenching it is to lose power, to have that power taken from you. Did you feel that?
Well, I wasn't happy. But as I said my 80th birthday in Paul's presence, I said, "I'm indebted to you, Paul, because if I hadn't left office then, I wouldn't have been able to marry Blanche. And so I'm really indebted to him."
The day you left office, you said your biggest regret as Prime Minister was you hadn't done enough for Aboriginal people.
Yeah,
what would you do now if you were Prime Minister for Aboriginal people?
I would put much more money into practical things like additional services in health and education for the Aboriginal people. Yeah, it is a blot on our society that their life expectancy is more than 10 years below ours, that their health is significantly below ours, I mean, non-Indigenous Australians. And these gaps must be narrowed. And that's one of the things I would concentrate on.
You were famous as a chairman of cabinet. Your ministers praised your abilities as a chairman of cabinet to effectively run a discussion and arrive at consensus with that cabinet. One of the most shocking things, I think, in recent years in politics, first under Kevin Rudd and seemingly under Tony Abbott now, is more power is going into the office of the Prime Minister, less things are going to cabinet for fear of leaks. Do you have a view on this, Bob?
Yeah, I think it's stupid. And I was, of course, extremely fortunate in that I had a remarkable cabinet. Hewson, before he went to Parliament, wrote as a journalist that my cabinet was the best since Federation. He was right, I think, on that. I think it remains true. I think that cabinet, that ministry, was the best in the history of Federation. And to me, it was absurd that you didn't draw upon the capacities of the people in your cabinet so that decisions had more strength. I said at my first meeting of the ministry, there's one thing we would not repeat, and one of the mistakes of the Whitlam government, and that was that you could have a situation, or they did have situations, where you could have a discussion in cabinet, a decision made, and then those who hadn't got their way could take the matter back to caucus and try and revivify it. I said, once the decision is made, that is it. I said, you'll have every opportunity to put your point of view. You'll never leave the cabinet room thinking you haven't had a chance to put your point of view. But once the decision's made, that's it. And they accepted that. And the overwhelming number of our decisions were made by consensus. But they themselves adopted the position from the beginning, if there was a position where there was a difference in opinion in the cabinet, the view of the Prime Minister would prevail. That's not something I sought to impose upon them, that's something they decided upon themselves.
You were an enthusiastic campaigner for Julia Gillard. I'm not quite so sure if you were so enthusiastic for Kevin Rudd. Did that mean you had some disquiet about the way he was operating, you know, 4 hours sleep a night, that kind of thing?
Well, I don't want to get into a discussion about Kevin. I think he speaks for himself.
Still, this was kind of a real watershed moment for the Labor Party and government in Australia to accrue all that power into the Prime Minister's office. Do you think maybe that broke him in the end and broke his government, wanting to run it the whole show from his office?
Of course, that's what finally brought him down. People got sick and tired of the virtual abolition of cabinet and the centralisation of decision-making in the Prime Minister's office. That was what eventually contributed to his downfall.
You had several, more than several, robust exchanges with members of the Australian media over the years in your time before and during your Prime Ministership. What do you think of the quality of political journalism today compared to your time in office, Bob?
Probably not as good, but there's one thing I want to say about Labor leadership and the media. I always said to my colleagues, don't blame the media. I said, we've got to make the decisions and make the right decisions that work. It's pointless blaming the media for any problems that you perceive that we have. And so that was a view I always took, and I think it's a sensible approach. But we had some considerable journalists in my time and before that. I don't think that quality is probably maintained at as quite a higher level as it was in those days.
How do you think you would have fared with a much more hyper-partisan media such as exists today?
Oh, well, again, I don't think that should be overplayed. In the end, you've got television, and no one can come between you and the public. There's no Murdoch influence there. You are talking to the public directly. That's why I keep saying, don't carry on about, you know, the undue influence of the media. We won in situations where we had the majority of the media against us, but you can't beat television.
Julia Gillard, as Prime Minister, used to talk about hard work quite a lot. And when she'd get a knock on the poll, she'd say, I will work harder and harder and harder. You, on the other hand, famously said, any boss who sacks a worker for showing up for work today is a bum. Where's the larrikinism gone in politics, Bob? What's happened to it?
Well, I think that it's just a question broadly of the quality of members of Parliament on both sides. I think it's not as high as it used to be. This is not just a problem in Australia. I was saying to someone the other day in a discussion, I think we're at a unique point in history that I think the period we're in now is the first period since the end of the Second World War when there hasn't been one outstanding leader anywhere in the democratic world. And I think this is a problem. Conservative side of politics is even more of a problem because the people who would think about going into politics on the conservative side, they would be making a very significant financial sacrifice, and I think that's one factor. But the other factor, I think, is, and this does go to the media, I think there's, over time, since my time, there's been an increasing intrusiveness by the media of all sorts into the private lives of politicians and their family. And I think a lot of men and women who would think about going and say, well, why in the bloody hell should I subject myself and my family to that?
Of course, Barack Obama is a serving world leader at the moment. How do you rate him?
Well, I like Obama. I'm sure his heart's in the right place. He's a great orator. But he didn't have any significant experience, executive experience, before becoming president. I think he could have appointed better people in many cases than he did. I think he's a good and decent man, but doesn't rank as a great leader. And what I see is a major shortcoming in his handling of the Middle East. In my judgment, and this is an area that I've had a great deal of interest in over the years, I think he should have got Netanyahu and the Hamas leadership and knocked their heads together and said, this is going to change. But he hasn't really done that.
You had such an emotional support for Israel in your time as leader. The Israel you fell in love with was the kind of Labour Party Israel of, you know, Golda Meir and the kibbutz. It's not the same Israel anymore. It's a very different place.
It's not the same Israel, that's right. But remember this, when I did give my support to Israel at that time, I was surrounded by people who had tried and continued to try to destroy it, and I didn't think that was fair and right, proper. But at all times, I had good relations with representatives of the Palestinian people, including their representative in Australia, who is always and remains a very good friend of mine. But I think it is a tragedy that Israel is not the country it was. I think it never will be under this leadership.
Howard Stringer, who is the, I don't know if he still is, but is the head of Sony International, made a speech a couple of years ago where he wanted to kick back at the idea of China as the coming power, insofar as he said, that's fine, but what does China actually have to offer the world right now, other than a chance to share in its growing wealth? Great empires and great powers in history have always offered the world something. What has China offered the world?
Well, what it has offered since Deng Xiaoping made what I think was the most significant decision taken by any political leader in the 20th century, that was his decision in late 1978 to move towards a market economy and open up the outside world. As a result of that decision, the best part of 3 billion people were brought into the world global economy. That is the 1.3 billion of China. The magnificent economic success of China was the single most important factor in the downfall of the Soviet Union. So that brings it another 500,000. And what's often forgotten is that India, until the downfall of the Soviet Union, had tended to follow them without being an absolute command economy. They didn't have a really open economy. But when the Soviet Union fell, India started its systematic reform and entry into the global economy. So the Chinese, under Deng Xiaoping, brought 3 billion people into the global economy. Now it's almost impossible to measure the significance of that in terms of the way it opened up trading opportunities.
What ideas, though, Bob? Ideas.
Well, just a minute, let me finish. And one idea they brought is it's important to uplift the standards of people. As a result of what Deng Xiaoping decided, something like 500,000,000 people were brought out of poverty. Now, what the Chinese has done has shown dramatically in this period that sensible economic policy and growth can lift the standard and quality of living of people. There's not much more you can do than that.
You've often said in the past that by nature and temperament you're an optimist. I am too. I'm an optimist by temperament, but my wife thinks I'm deluded. Does Blanche think you're deluded, or is she an optimist as well?
Blanche and I share very much in common in our thinking about international matters, and I think, you know, we feel less than fully optimistic about the future. One's got to understand that in the Cold War, which was a very dangerous time, At least you knew the geographical location of your enemy or your potential enemy. But now you have a situation where terrorism is so rife that you can't identify your enemy in the way you could before, and that creates all sorts of difficulties. And we must not underestimate the threat there is to the world from international terrorism. But I do want to make this point, that it's absolutely essential, if we're going to handle this situation in an optimum fashion, that we don't make the mistake of thinking of terrorism as Islamic fanatics. True, they are there in abundance and are a great source of problem. But the other great religions have their fanatics too. I was recently talking with some Jewish friends of mine, and they were going on about the Muslim fanatics. I said to them, remember this, the Israeli Prime Minister, Rabin, was not assassinated by a Muslim fanatic, it was by a Jewish fanatic. And of course the Christians have their fanatics. The Christian right in the United States urged on George Bush Jr. into that awful and counterproductive war in Iraq. So the three great religions have their fanatics, and we must be wary of them all. I just hope our leaders, not just our political leaders, but our religious leaders, will hold out their hands and say to the people of all faiths, we respect your faiths. We want you to work together so that the extremes within all our religions are going to be minimised in terms of their impact. If we can do that, we have some chance of a world at peace. But there are great ifs and buts about that. And of course, the other issue, if you're talking about optimism about the future, of course, is global warming. People who don't accept the fact that there are great dangers facing the future viability of our planet are doing themselves, their children, their successive generations an enormous disservice. The evidence is indisputable that the world is becoming a more... more dangerous place. And if global warming continues to rise at the rate it has, then the world is in danger within a century of becoming virtually inhabitable in terms that we know.
You're not a believer, but you're not an atheist either. You're an agnostic.
Yeah.
If this turns out to be your one and only life, are you fine with that?
Well, there's nothing I can do about it, is there? I just want to say this, that I don't think about death. I'm not frightened by death. I'm not worried by death. I've had a fortunate life, a life which has satisfied me, and in a judgment I can make as objective as I possibly can, I think it's been a life which has been useful to others, then I'm happy. If this is it, well, it's it.
And it is it. Bob Hawke, thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Hawke and Richard Feynman. Imagine.
That conversation with Bob Hawke was recorded in late December at the Woodford Folk Festival on the Sunshine Coast hinterland in Queensland. And many thanks to Bill Horitz and Lisa Watts from Woodford for making it all happen, and also to Mr. Robert Aussie Bob Apolloni for his technical wizardry yet again.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.